Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I am in Dumfries. It's a smallish town. Martin says, as we walk to the pub, it's bid to be seen as a city field. Oh dear, I say. I hope that's not a sign and Dumfries doesn't feel me or us, as we're new and we've potential. I don't tell Martin I'd read that the nickname for the town is the Queen of the South. I save it for later, as there's an easy laugh to be had there, and it's my first visit to his. We may have some awkward moments that need lightening. Walking down the high street, the usual shops are all present, just like any town in the UK. I love looking above shop fronts, I say. When I lived in London, I'd ride upstairs on double-deckers. You'd see how beautiful the buildings once were. The bricks the buildings here are made from are large and dark grey. Some might say it makes the place look dull or austere. I find the colour and the size of the stone comforting. I feel safe, sturdy, important. In the middle of the street before us, a beautiful old rectangular building. It looks like it's been here longer than everything at either side, like the high street has been built around it. It wouldn't look out of place on a postcard, or when I saw it again the following night, its old lamps shining through a vague mist at a group of tourists standing huddled by its steps, like a scene on a Christmas card. Martin says he gets it, that weddings take place in it nowadays, and that makes sense to my eyes. What makes less sense is when he tells me it was originally a prison. I can't make that work in my head, but it's a fact. I try to wash away what I've painted over this place. I try to restore it to the original, but I can't. I see what I see. Painted hoardings push out into the high street, blocking the view of the lower floor of the building on the left. It's deceiving. Martin says, it looks like another shop front in the row, but this building goes really far back. He points to the sky. At the top of that one, there's a roof garden. I can't see any hint of it. Here, he says, the statue of Robert the Bruce. This is where he, and I miss what he says, because my eyes have taken priority for receiving. In the church behind, he says, although that's not where the church was when it actually happened. Tourists go to see this famous spot, but Martin points across the square. The church was over there originally. That's where it really happened, he says. It's a Greg's Bakery now. We go to the Doogie, the closest thing Dumfries has to a gay bar. It's a blast. DJs and drag queens and a girl from Newry who tells me how raging she is she didn't get to be Irish because she's a big prod. She makes jokes about Catholics being dirty and having too many children, and something I don't hear that must have gone really below the belt because it made the people run from the table with raised eyebrows and ducked heads. I think they were expecting the second troubles, but I bought her a drink. I like her. I'm surprised and soothed that the younger generation are carrying on the Northern Irish humour that can clear a room faster than a bomb scare. Martin and I walk home, back up the high street, seeing it in reverse. I'm warm with alcohol and connection. I take his hand. Is it safe here? I ask. The usual, he says. We make our way off the high street and round a corner. It's a little darker. I look at the building ahead, look above, and see the flats above the shop front. One night I heard someone shouting abuse at me and my friend from there. He pointed at the flats I was looking at. We weren't even a couple, but they knew. We turned back and saw a guy hanging out of that window. There was a party going on. So we shouted back at him, and we weren't expecting him to go mad and him and his mates to run out and chase us, but we were faster. He's telling me this as we walk towards that flat. I would have walked home a different way if I lived here. The cartography of this town has changed in my eyes. We walk around the corner, and some lads are swaying towards us, and one bangs off a lamppost. I let go of Martin's hand, but he links my arm, maybe to make me feel safe, maybe to insist that we shouldn't have to stop being ourselves. I'm uncomfortable, but I'm concentrating on every move these guys make and where their eyes are resting. But they are too drunk to focus on anything other than putting one foot in front of the other. After they have passed, we're silent, and I feel like a coward. I'm rooting around in my head for something to say I remember about the Queen of the South, but I can't make it funny. I take Martin's hand instead, and we share a kiss in the street without a care of who sees, the way two people with potential should.
Hello, everybody. I'm honored to be here, honored to be in this city with these writers, with these musicians. You were playing the bass on that, too. That's learning to hear as well as learning to see. Extraordinary. And to be with you all. Thank you so much for your company today. And thank you to John Berger, who taught us not to trust what we see and who taught us to notice what we don't see. He was revolutionary. At the time, and he still is, and we need him now more than ever. Here's two poems. The first one is called Postscript. What we did to the earth, we did to our daughters, one after the other. What we did to the trees, we did to our elders, stacked in their wheelchairs by the lunchroom door. What we did to our daughters, we did to our sons, calling out for their mothers. What we did to the trees, what we did to the earth, we did to our sons, to our daughters. What we did to the cow, to the pig, to the lamb, we did to the earth, butchered and milked it. Few of us knew what the bird calls meant or what the fires were saying. We took of earth and took and took, and the earth seemed not to mind until one of our daughters shouted, "It was right in front of you, right in front of your eyes, and you didn't see." The air turned red. The ocean grew teeth. My daughter I just learned this word, directionally dyslexic. Is anybody here? She cannot tell right from left. It's a funny term. Are you all laughing because it's funny? It is funny, but she's left-handed. I say, what's left is on your left hand. It doesn't happen. It's a brain thing, right? So this poem is dedicated to her. It's a small poem. It's called The Map. The failure of love might account for most of the suffering in the world. The girl was going over her global studies homework in the air, where she drew a map with her finger, touching the Gobi Desert, the plateau of Tiber in front of her, and looking through her transparent map backwards, I suddenly did see how her left is my right. And for a moment, I understood. Thank you. Thank you.
ways of seeing. This is actually about something that no one listening will ever see. There's a poem on the wall of our bedroom, and the text is handwritten in ink in careful calligraphy. There's a tiny detailed illustration of a boat on the sea in the margin, like a monk's manuscript. And apart from the family, it's the one thing I would save from the flames. It was written as a wedding present from a friend, Leon Macaulay, poet, broadcaster from County Antrim. And I remember him saying, I'm working on something special. Don't you worry about it at all. And because I'm from Newry and my wife is from Derry, the poem is called The Oak and the Yew. And it begins with this invitation. My love, build me a vessel of oak and supple yew, its body broad as constancy, its mast both tall and true. And when Leon showed it to me first, I think I cried, to be honest. He'd written it beautifully. He'd used beautiful paper, mounted it with some card, set it in a frame. And 29 years on, the ink has faded to the point where the little boat on the sea is kind of disappearing, but I won't replace it. It's always been there. And to the point where I don't see it for months, and then I notice it and I stop and reread it. And it was only recently that I thought I should really take a photograph of it in case it got lost. But it won't get lost. It's nailed to the wall, and the only people who know it's there are the two of us. Leon never actually asked me about what he might write for a young couple getting married. We never discussed the poem at all. He just made it like a craftsman, with good paper, a good pen and ink and paint and nails and glue and care and attention. Very appropriate given that it's all about the idea of building this boat of solid oak and supple yew. Leon saw a beauty, a magic that caught up in wedding plans and invitations and suits and nights out. I just couldn't. When we got the keys for our first house, I remember lying down on the floor that day and being so happy as the shadows made by the sun on the window bars moved slowly across the dark blue carpet. To anyone else, it was a room with bare walls and no furniture, but this was our house, a new house, new town, new life, and we mightn't have had a chair to sit on, but we'd soon have a beautiful, heartfelt poem to put in the wall. I'll never tell Leon's poem to anyone. It's not for the world to see. And I couldn't, to be honest, because that poem contains my heart in a way I don't think any other thing ever has. It finishes like this. We'll fill its boughs with wonders. We'll fill its hold with tales. And we'll gather in the silences and sing against the gales. Thank you.
Inspired by those beautiful words, we're going to sing a song that first started out as a poem written by the Scots poet Robert Tannahill in the 18th century. It contains the lyrics, "And merrily we'll sing as the storms rattle o'er us." And in the 20th century, it was picked up by a Belfast family, the McPeaks, and they made it their own. So we'd love to sing with you, if you know the words, Wild Mountain Time.
Summer. is coming, and the trees are sweetly blooming, and the wild mice.
It's really nice to be here. This poem depicts me as a very young and very incompetent Gaelic keeper, but also that it imagines my father observing me being different without me having the language yet to describe that. Keeper. To my memory, I was always on a Gaelic pitch in autumn, the trees low and big brown mounds of leaves, a spectrum of brown thrown in the air by balls skimming the tops like a scalping razor. Relegated to the goalposts, those strong legs of the better team, I watch amazed as they run, roll and weave, as brave as otters, an owl watching them play. With my end of the pitch often vacant and shoutless, I would busy myself with the gravel stones beneath me, articulating them lovingly into stone palaces around the posts. I wanted to inhabit each one and feel at home. My father leans on the sidelines without a cap, the autumn chill not so unmanageable yet, his bald head like the scored ground under a wooden swing where wildflowers have a chance. He begins to yell, "Micheál, Micheál," and not in disappointment or embarrassment, as I thought immediately, but to pull me from reverie as leather ball whirled towards my cheek. The rasp in his voice, not due to my softness, I learned years later. No, it was how he lay witness to a great pain careening towards me through the cold air and could not catch it. My partner and I entertained a brief psychotic episode where we thought we could buy a house together. And this poem emerged from that episode. Walking through empty houses. Receiving the customary chill passing Paisley's Church, a theological spank on the bottom, we are soon greeted as two brothers by the gelé-wound estate agent. He struggled to turn his BMW, cobalt and sleek, in the tiny cul-de-sac. A writer, is it? BMW asks if you're proud, and I wonder, does he mean our mother? Somewhere in Ballysillan seems promising. Then three articles unspool about three Catholic families prevented from moving in. Not too west, not too east. For the first time, I wish my name away. Packs of miserable people, a kettle of vultures awaiting Susie, the estate agent, to disembark her micra. Poor Susie, friendly, but without enough hunks of meat for all the jet black jackals with our red eyes. She unlocks the bright pink door, perfect for poofs, I say, you frown. And desperate people abandon small cars and umbrellas. We speak quietly as we step through a small terraced house, as though on consecrated ground, wherein we do not belong. Having endured the last "what's for you" well wish, I go catatonic in Boy Park. Simple are my requests, to cook eggs well on a stove I inherit, while looking out to a yard painted mint green, pebbles in terracotta pots, from which nasturtiums erupt and crawl the walls, to lie in bed and watch a stippled ceiling, sounds of kids tumbling up and down the stairs next door, rather than paramilitaries kicking the other men out of the house beside. For the lock to be strong, the windows to be open, a front door to be painted a lively colour, to be undisturbed with my cats on a cheap upright, for those squares of sun on the rug to be mine. Very generous audience. This last one. My mother would have always told me that people in Derry of her generation were bred to leave. Being the hero of mine that she is, she neglected to follow that advice, so I decided to follow suit. Travelling poem. Planes the size of friends leave the city in swathes. What feels daily these days? My mother and I drink coffee, wincing as each colourful flight roars overhead. The black coffee is bitter. Goodbye. A shame, Mummy says, all they'll miss. Gesturing to the delicate white blooms of a tree hanging lithely over a blue car. Or perhaps she means this place, the fire and words and people between the thin flowers and the stone balcony. She is wise in this regard, having shredded papers and ambition to play a violin all across a life. The radio's frequency prioritizes the music of elsewhere. The best part of a decade has been given to my roots, sinking into this damp soil, in knowledge that difficulty remains difficult by a poolside or a municipal park. Arrival is just a feeling that comes in those broad seconds in an unfamiliar place where clarity meets strangeness, like that morning on Baggot Street where the canal stilled and Charlotte linked my arm, where the sky cleared grey into blue and Kavanagh sat observing the rushes. Arrival is attention, and each morning I arrive to my mother thinking of me. I drive to see her. Life is fragrant. Thank you.
This poem is set somewhere between here and County Clare. It evokes, in some respects, the fable of De Danann and the seven foals that jumped off Isle na Searraigh near Doolin. It's called The Whisperer and it's for Martin. Today she woke remembering an old story. Seven wild horses leaping from a cliff top, diving to the ocean 500 feet below. As with the best of all fables, nothing is as first it seemed. A story from a woman so long in the wilderness, 5 years and five again. Her ritual, confiding in the sea, to cast seven old love letters on horses' backs out into the waves scattering in all directions until they hitched a sea change north in the Atlantic drift from Carrigaholt, Lahinch, Spanish Point, washing up in some distant archipelago in Scandinavia. Jumbled signals, ionized and crackling with white noise. Her lover is a seer, unshowy and modest. He'd impressed her with persistence, solemn vows, sincerity, past the brutal father, others, the passive, the caustic, the neglectful, the mean of spirit, the casual and selfish, the snivelling and sadistic, the weak and cowardly, the good, the otherwise committed, the simply envious. She was a woman, flinching ipso facto every time he reached across another crumpled hotel bed to touch her face, though she craved him and though he was kind, unfailingly so. He is a whisperer of sorts, it seems, gifted with deciphering silences, code, encryption, love. erotic romance from the broken spaces in between. He believed her, divining the familiar, the domestic, the glorious ordinary, all life a shelter, a realm, a province grounded out of the imagination and echoing in pulse on pulse as light across the darkness from a tower out at sea, infinite, tending a beacon blazing in an open cupola, guiding her back, contented of her own accord.
We'll stay close to the sea for a song. We're going to go to the north coast of Ireland, but not just the north coast, all the way up the Western Isles of Scotland, to the folklore again of Norway and Iceland, where there persists a creature that the locals speak about. And it is said, we did some research in the UCD Folklore Commission, and the O'Kane clan is connected to these creatures for centuries. So it is believed the O'Kane people are in fact the Selkie people, half seal, half human. They come on the land, and if you watch out for them, sometimes you can see them swim away. This is one of our own Selkie song.
You've been listening to Sunday Miscellany, Ways of Seeing, recorded as part of Belfast Book Festival at the Crescent Arts Centre, Belfast. The scripts were Queen of the South by Paul McVeigh, two poems by Mary Howe, The Oak and the Yew by John Toll, three poems by Micheál McCann, and The Whisperer, a poem by Maria McManus. The music was On the Street Where You Live by Frederick Lowe, played by Scott Flanagan on keyboard. The Braes of Ochter Tyre, played by Sinead McKenna on fiddle and Mickey Fearon on guitar. Wild Mountain Thyme, performed by True, who are Donal Kearney, Zach Troughton and Michael Mormica. The Mushroom Tree and the Kid on the Mountain, played by Emer McGeown on whistle and Donna Hennessy on guitar, and Selkie Song, also by True. On sound were Tom Norton and Kieran Cullen. Special thanks also to Belfast Book Festival director Sophie Hales and co-curator Neil Hegarty. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE Radio 1 website or on the RTE Radio 1 player.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.